Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Juan Gonzalez. He is the co-host of Democracy Now! He's a columnist for the New York Daily News, and he's co-author with Joseph Torres of the new book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mayor Charlotte. My pleasure to be here.
This is an extraordinary book. It spans the whole of American history from the colonial period to the present. It reads like a people's history of the American press. I thought today, given that we don't have 6 hours to talk about the book, we could talk about the period before the 20th century. What were the first newspapers in the colonies, and what kinds of stories did they report?
Well, you know, one of the things, the reasons why my co-author and I decided to do this kind of expansive look is that we were frustrated as a modern journalist, not being able to understand why the press had so much difficulty in sort of really reflecting the diversity of the American experience. And so we decided to go back to the beginning. And actually, we started with the first newspaper in North America, really, public occurrences, foreign and domestic, which was published only one issue in 1690, and it was only a three-page paper. When we started to read it, we realized that a huge portion of that first paper in the Massachusetts colony was directed to providing intelligence to the settlers about what the Native Americans were up to, what the first editor, Benjamin Harris, called those miserable savages and skulking Indians. And actually, five articles in that first paper were devoted to information about the Native Americans. None of it, except for one article, none of it, what we would call positive, that one article was about how the Christianized Indians of Plymouth were celebrating Thanksgiving. But other than that, the first newspaper in North America sort of set the template. The next paper was John Campbell's Boston Newsletter in 1704. Campbell devoted a lot of space to informing the settlers about what the African slaves were up to and the free blacks in the Massachusetts colony, so that you have from the very beginning in the American press enormous amount of time and space spent informing the white settler population about what the natives and the African slaves or free blacks were up to. And I think that this then we trace what happens as the press grows, first in the colonies, then in the New Republic, and how it moves from being just a press primarily for the elite to a press for the masses, really beginning around the 1830s in the Jacksonian period. And we thus trace that even before any African Americans or Latinos or Native Americans began developing their own press, a huge portion of the, quote, white press was spending a lot of time providing images, many of them distorted and one-sided, of what non-white peoples that were coexisting with the European settlers in the United States were doing.
What were the early narratives about slavery in the southern and northern colonial newspapers?
Well, there were two main topics, I guess, in the colonial period: slave insurrections and violence by or threats by blacks in the north to white settlers, and those were predominantly the main topics. Similarly with the Native Americans, at a certain point in the early 1700s, as much as a third of the content of newspapers was devoted to Indian wars, to clashes between the white settlers and the Native Americans. But a huge portion was also devoted to perceived or imagined violence by Africans against the settler population. And the examples, there's all kinds of examples, and let me just give you some if I can. There was For instance, in 1712, the Boston Newsletter reported one of the earliest slave rebellions in the colonies. 70 New York Negroes, it claimed, had been arrested for, quote, their late conspiracy to murder the Christians. And over the next 60 years, colonial newspapers chronicled about 50 separate incidents of actual or suspected slave revolts. Now, many of these revolts weren't in the American colonies. They were in the Caribbean. They were on ships coming to the New World. But the colonial newspapers felt their responsibility to keep the settlers abreast of any possible insurrections. And in 1740, for instance, the Boston Evening Post published a letter from an angry resident who was trying to organize a vigilante group to control slave conduct. And this the writer writes, quote, "The great disorders committed by Negroes who are permitted by their imprudent masters to be out late at night has determined several sober and substantial housekeepers to walk about the town in the sore part of the night." So that the paper was publicizing the creation of a vigilante group to keep an eye on the slaves when they weren't at work. So this was commonplace in the colonial newspapers. So that really race was a major topic of our press from its very inception. And it is a portion of the history of the media that rarely gets much attention. Of course, it went on, and once the country became independent and as the westward expansion developed, the frontier newspapers were filled with stories about Native Americans, particularly, and some frontier newspapers played major roles in sort of fomenting the climate that led to major massacres. The Rocky Mountain News, for instance, created a real climate of fear that led to the Sand Creek Massacre of Native Americans in Colorado. The Tucson Citizen and several Arizona papers were heavily involved not only in creating a climate that led to a major massacre of Apaches in the Arizona Territory, but then in defending the white citizens who were put on trial for the massacre and eventually acquitted. So these newspapers had a major role in helping to create this, what we call the white racial narrative, the first draft of the white racial narrative in American history. And we've also documented an extraordinary number of race riots that were, again, fomented by newspaper publishers, sometimes with the publishers actually directly participating or leading the mob after writing articles for several days in their local, in their newspapers, agitating the population. Then the publishers actually took direct leadership role. The one that we found to be most appalling, because it was a person who later played such a pivotal role in the American government, was the Wilmington coup of 1898. This is one that's gotten very little attention, even though recently, a few years back, there was actually a commission in North Carolina established to set the record straight on what had happened in 1898. But this was just after the Spanish-American War. And what happened in Wilmington was really the first and only successful armed coup in American history. It was at the tail end of the Black Reconstruction governments in the South, as white Democrats were once again establishing power throughout the South. And in Wilmington, North Carolina, had a majority Black population and had a, as a result of Reconstruction, had a majority Black city council together with some white Republicans. They were basically running the town. The editor and publisher of the main newspaper, the Raleigh News and Observer, the main newspaper in the state, was Josephus Daniels, who was also a leader of the white resistance. He was a populist. He was a follower of William Jennings Bryan. And Josephus Daniels, for weeks on end, led a campaign in his newspaper, which he admits in his biography he planned and plotted with the white leaders of the town, to discredit the existing government in Wilmington And then shortly after the November election of 1898, when white Democrats swept through power in the rest of the state, but they did not control Wilmington, several thousand armed whites marched into town. They burned down the local black newspaper. They then engaged in gun battles throughout the town that resulted in the deaths of as many as 60 black citizens. They rounded up all of the elected black officials at gunpoint, put them on trains, and shipped them out of town. And they appointed a former Confederate colonel to be the new mayor of Wilmington. It was an outright racially motivated coup, and the federal government did nothing about it. And Josephus Daniels was celebrated as the mastermind and the leader of this coup. Now, you might put this down to just a rabid segregationist extremist, but Josephus Daniels ended up becoming, once Woodrow Wilson was elected president, because he was one of Wilson's closest advisors, Josephus Daniels ended up becoming Secretary of the Navy during World War One. He, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected president, Roosevelt, who had been one of his assistants in the Navy Department during World War One, then appointed him to as ambassador to Mexico. Josephus Daniels, while he was in charge of the Navy, really was one of the key people who determined the development of the radio system in America, because the radio system really was taken over by the Navy during World War One, and the Navy really shaped the development of post-war radio in the 1920s, to the point that the Navy had one of its admirals, Admiral Bullard, who sat on the board of directors of the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, which was the trust that the government sponsored to run radio in America after World War One. So Josephus Daniels was a major figure in the American media, not just in print, but in terms of his influence on radio. And yet he was literally the leader of an illegal armed coup that led to the deaths of scores of African Americans. And yet this part of Josephus Daniels' history is almost unknown. It wasn't until the Wilmington Commission recently issued a report acknowledging the failings of the white leadership of the state back in 1898, and that the Wilmington News and Observer and the Raleigh paper issued public apologies, that we finally began to get some of this historical record recognized. But there are many other examples that we've uncovered in the book of editors and publishers not merely providing one-sided or stereotypical reporting, but actually using their publications to incite hate, division, and even murder and massacres.
We're talking to Juan Gonzalez about his book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. I think one of the kind of narratives that we have in our minds that the book completely busts is that non-white people were invisible in the media before the most recent civil rights era. In fact, they were highly visible, but portrayed in an almost entirely racist manner. Were there any significant dissenting voices in the mainstream press?
Yes. Well, that was one of the things that we also wanted to highlight, that there were those who bravely stood against sort of the reigning opinion. One of the most interesting was Benjamin Franklin. In 1754, there was a massacre of Native Americans in Pennsylvania by a group of white settlers. Franklin, at the time, apparently was angry that the only two newspapers in the colony, both in Philadelphia, were reporting nothing about it. And one of them had been a paper that he had originally founded. So Franklin then penned a pamphlet basically to break the news blackout about this massacre and to alert the fair-minded Quakers and Moravians, other settlers who were opposed to these kinds of attacks on the native population. And it was a stirring expose of what had happened. and why the settlers had attacked the wrong group of Indians. And basically, it was sort of like the first call to not lump all people together and to understand that no matter what the race, the nationality, or the group of people, there are differences among all peoples, and you can't lump everyone together. Just because you are attacked by an Indian, you don't then go and attack any Indian you can find, was basically Franklin's argument. And he was able to rally a large group of fair-minded settlers in Pennsylvania to oppose a second attempt at a massacre and actually confront those of their fellow settlers who were bent on attacking other Indians in the colony. Thomas Paine was another one who constantly raised that here were the American rebels and their Patriot Prince, because many of the newspapers in the colonial period were instrumental in fomenting the independence war against England. But Paine kept raising, here you talk about liberty, but meanwhile we're holding tens of thousands of Africans as slaves, and you're ignoring their need for liberty as well. So there were definitely isolated voices throughout American history in the white population that bravely stood up to sort of the reigning narrative in the press, but certainly not as many as you'd hope. Obviously, William Lloyd Garrison and his Liberator was perhaps the greatest example, not only because it championed abolition, but also because Garrison was one of the few who actually asked African Americans to write articles in his paper. And in fact, major periods of time, the majority of the subscribers to Garrison's Liberator were African Americans, not white Americans. So that there were many examples of those who were brave enough to stand up. But unfortunately, for most of the press, it participated in and sort of amplified the white racial narrative.
How did newspapers that were sympathetic with abolitionists then deal with issues of race and Reconstruction after the Civil War?
One of the things that we realize is obviously there's a reigning narrative about Reconstruction that W.E.B. Du Bois and others tried to unmask, which is that Reconstruction in the South was this period of total corruption and lawlessness and uneducated African Americans running governments during the years after the Civil War. But a lot of that was unfortunately spread by the press, writers from the North who would go to the South and who would then spread these kinds of views to the general population. One of the things that we've actually, that I think is sort of a new aspect of what we've done with the book, is we've looked at the role of the wire services in the white racial narrative, because obviously for decades, the Associated Press and the United Press International were hugely important in terms of providing most of the copy that would go into the many small town newspapers across the country. In some periods of American history, as much as 80% of the news content of Midwest and Western papers was AP wire copy. And AP wire copy was all coming out of New York City. It was a cooperative controlled by a handful of New York City publishers. And they would get wire copy from around the country, and then they would digest it every day into a certain number of stories, and then they would send those stories out to the rest of their member papers. So in essence, in the late 19th century, the Associated Press, especially because it was far bigger than any of the other wire services, became the centralizer of news and information in America. And the Associated Press would depend on its local editors and publishers to provide it news from a particular area, because it only would recognize one paper as an AP paper in a particular town. So that paper would then become the dominant voice, so that the AP and the wire services, by their very structure, centralized news in the late 19th century and centralized the racial narrative. So that if a southern newspaper, let's say in Mississippi, was a member of the Associated Press, the only news and information that the rest of the world would get about what was coming, what was happening in Mississippi, was from that one AP newspaper that would send it to New York, and then New York would disseminate it to the rest of the world. So, unfortunately, this is how the very structure of the wire services helped to what we believe is mass-produce the white racial narrative. Because before the wire services, you had what was essentially hundreds of local newspapers all around the country, each serving their local constituencies. And while some of them were partisan and many of them were racist, there was at least competition and the struggle of ideas between competing newspapers. But in the second half of the 19th century, you have what we call the centralization of news that began, the mass production and centralization of the content of news as a result of the wire services. And so that affected what people in Minnesota or California or Ohio were learning about Mississippi. They were learning it from their local newspaper, which was carrying an AP wire copy that had come out of New York, but which had been created by that local Mississippi newspaper. So that was the late 19th century saw a real sort of decline in the little bit of diversity in news that had occurred. Because in the early 19th century, there actually were quite a few what we call counter-narratives. There were many African-American, Latino, even Native American newspapers that developed that told a different story. For instance, the city of New Orleans, before the Civil War, there were 25 separate Spanish-language newspapers that were started in New Orleans, including a daily, Patria, in the 1840s, that were all producing news and information, and because of the government's postal subsidies, were able to get into the hands of people who subscribed to them. New Mexico had large numbers of newspapers. Texas, South Texas, California began to have Spanish language newspapers. And of course, as we focus in on two of the really extraordinary experiments we believe in journalism by people of color, the Cherokee Phoenix, the first Native American newspaper in the world, which started in 1828, and later the Cherokee Advocate in the Oklahoma Territory. So here were Native Americans, Asian Americans, starting with the Golden Hills News in San Francisco in 1854. As I said, dozens of African American and Spanish language newspapers, all sort of flowering in the early 19th century and some into the late 19th century. But then all of them, of course, were excluded from the AP. So once the AP gained centralized control over information flows, you had sort of a decline in the ability of people of color to tell a different story in the American press. And so the late 19th century became a lot more difficult period of time for a counter-narrative to reach the public.
We're talking to Juan Gonzalez about his book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. Tell us about the beginning of low-cost newspapers geared toward a mass audience. You write specifically about the New York Sun.
Right. Well, I think that this is, again, this is a part of our history that we've really not come to grips with. As I said, before the 1830s, your average newspaper was basically an intelligence sheet for the elite of any community. The average paper, remember, there were no street corner sales in those days. The paper was delivered by the postal system, and the postal system played a very big role in creating our initial press because of subsidized postal rates that Congress decided on in 1792. But the average paper was about $10 a year subscription. You had to pay the subscription up front, and then you'd get the paper delivered through the post office for the rest of the year. So most workers and the poorer sections of the population could not afford the paper. Then along comes Benjamin Day, who had been active in the incipient labor movement of the late 1820s and 1830s in New York City. And Benjamin Day decides to start a penny paper where the average cost of the $10 a year paper was 6 cents. So he was going to start a penny paper, and he was not going to sell it by subscription that you'd have to pay it up front for the rest of the year. You could buy it every day because he would get newsboys to hawk it in the streets of New York. And Benjamin Day's New York Sun becomes the first true mass circulation paper in America. Within a few months, it's selling thousands upon thousands of copies. And it is then replicated by many other publishers, with the New York Herald and others that arise. And so you have the development of the penny press, the mass circulation newspaper for urban workers. Now, interestingly, the penny press develops at the very moment that urban workers are getting the right to vote. In the late 1820s, one by one, all the states began to eliminate property qualifications for voting. And so suddenly you have this mass of new voters between the presidential election of 1824 and the presidential election of 1828. The size of the national electorate doubled because of these of the removal of property qualifications. So in effect, what happens at that point is that the penny press, the commercial mass press, develops precisely at the time that urban workers are getting the right to vote. Therefore, the press becomes very instrumental in shaping the thinking of this mass of urban workers during the Jacksonian era. And that press becomes increasingly marked by two political trends. One, support for westward expansion of the country, for the conquest of more lands to the west, and obviously in support of the Mexican War. And two, it becomes rapidly, for the most part, except with a few exceptions, it becomes rapidly pro-slavery. And so you have a situation where the penny press, at the same time that it is championing the cause of urban workers and the 10-hour day and the right to unionize, it is also championing conquest of Western territories, and it is also championing slavery. And so, unfortunately, while it is, it was more a press geared to the urban workers, it was also a press that stoked racist and expansionist views, anti-Native American, anti-Mexican, and anti-Black.
And it also really fostered sensationalist stories and kind of junky tabloid types of writing.
Yes, that was the beginning of sort of the modern tabloid approach to journalism, lurid stories about murders and stories that had a sexual angle to them, sensational stories. And the Sun really pioneered this sort of feature approach to journalism. Obviously, journalism before then had been kind of staid. Most of the papers were large, huge broadsheets. Most of the articles were written either by the editors themselves or their friends or their acquaintances. What the penny press did was not only begin having actual reporters reporting those stories, but also trying to appeal to sort of the lowest common denominator that they could in terms of getting interest by the urban workers. And so you had a lot more attention to the sensational stories we now call tabloid journalism. But at the same time, they were also very political. And as I said, the politics involved support for expansionism, support for slavery, opposition to the rights of Native Americans, and these other issues.
You spoke before about government support of newspapers by way of postal subsidies. Going forward to the wire service, there's another interesting moment where Samuel Morse offered to sell his technology to the U.S. government, and decades of debate ensued. What was at issue there, and what happened?
Well, this is one of the main themes that we have throughout the book, which is we examine at every stage in the development of new technology in mass communications. Because one of our themes is that what happens is technology, for the most part, is a revolutionary force. Because whenever a new technology comes around, it subverts the existing order of how news and information is conveyed to the general public. This subversion of the existing order requires the government to step in and establish new rules of operation for how information and news will flow in America. And we have had repeated instances throughout the history of the country of these constitutive moments where our political leaders are forced to think about how will news and information reach the people in a democracy. The first great debate was in 1792, and it was over the creation of the post office. This was a major political debate. And throughout the 19th century, this was a perennial debate in Congress. People think of the post office now as this albatross, but the post office really was the central administrative apparatus of the United States throughout the 19th century. And this big debate arose in 1792. Will the government postal system deliver newspapers for free? Will it deliver newspapers at the cost of delivering them, or will it deliver them at something in between? You had among the founders of the country huge differences. Washington and Jefferson were much more in favor of free delivery, under the theory that the greatest possible dissemination of news and information was vital to keeping this new republic alive. And therefore, the more information that people had, the better chance the republic had of surviving. Others like Madison and were in favor of a market system charge publishers whatever it cost to deliver their newspapers. Congress eventually decided on a compromise, which was what's called the second class postage. It was at a rate lower than the normal mail, but not totally for free. This was a monumental decision. This, in essence, created the first internet, because basically the government was delivering newspapers to its citizens at subsidized rates. And as a result, the United States had the greatest proliferation of newspapers per person of any country in the world. And as a result, the American people throughout the early 19th century were more educated about what was happening in their government and in society. No matter where you went in America, no matter how far your home was from a town, the government would create postal roads and would deliver the newspaper to you. And the postal system was the largest employer of the federal government until the Civil War. 90% of the traffic of the postal system was not letters, it was newspapers. So in essence, you could argue that what the principal job of the federal government throughout the first half of the 19th century was delivering newspapers to its people. After the Civil War, the Army became the largest employer in the federal government. But the post office's main job continued to be the delivery of newspapers into the 20th century. Even as late as the 20th century, 90% of the traffic of the postal system was newspapers. What happened is every year there was a debate, how big will the postal subsidies be? Will local newspapers get better subsidies than newspapers from out of town? Because what would happen is the local, let's say you were a political leader in Alabama or in Tennessee, you wanted your local papers to have in-state papers to have a bigger subsidy than the out-of-state papers from New York, because if you didn't, then the out-of-state papers from New York would eventually put your local papers out of business. So there was in 1890s the government decided on free delivery to rural news to rural areas of the country, and therefore if you were a publisher in a rural area of the United States, all you had to do was print the paper and the government would deliver it for free to all the farms that your paper claimed to reach. So there were all kinds of incentives of the government built in to maintain a local press, not to have a central national press. So the government policy was decentralization of news and information flow throughout the early 19th century and into the late 20th century. However, when the new technology of the telegraph came, a new debate arose, well, will the telegraph be like the postal system? Most other countries decided yes. And in most other countries, the telegraph became an extension of the postal system. And Morse offered to sell his patents to the government so that it could have a government-owned telegraph. However, the business community opposed that, and the business community eventually won. And the telegraph in the United States developed differently. As a result, it was much more expensive than telegraphs in other parts of the world. And as a result, the telegraph and telegrams became the way that the business community, that speculators, that investors transmitted information to each other, and not the way that the American people were able to communicate. So that the telegraph, again, resulted in sort of a centralization of news and information because only the wire services could afford to use the wires to get news and information out. So basically what happened, you had the postal system, the first constitutive decision in American media technology, in American media policy, decentralized information flow. The telegraph centralized information flow. But of course what happens is that technology keeps developing. So by the early 20th century, you had a new communications technology, wireless, which became radio. And at that point, once again, the whole system was thrown into a convulsion, and the government once again had to decide what it was going to do, because suddenly thousands of amateur radio operators were taken to the airwaves. Stations were developing all over the place. They were interfering with each other's frequencies. The business community couldn't get business done, and so you had eventually the government's creation of the Federal Radio Commission in 1927, and then the Federal Communications Commission in 1934, which was the third major constitutive decision of the federal government in media policy. And once again, the government centralized everything, and increasingly decided to bring order to the airwaves by licensing, not only by licensing all operators, but also by pushing for a few companies. The Radio Trust that the government itself had helped create, the Radio Corporation of America, and then later CBS, the CBS networks, to dominate the best frequencies. And little by little, you had the rise of the three major networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, that once again centralized the flow of information and news into these giant combinations, similar to the Associated Press and Western Union model of the late 19th century. But again, the technology keeps developing, and pretty soon you had the growth of cable television, which once again destabilized the existing broadcasting order, because all of a sudden you needed to have cable lines strong in every city, so you could have more channels, but that meant you needed local government approval of the rights of way. And suddenly the system became decentralized again because every local government had the right now to approve a cable franchise and require certain things of the cable owners. And so for a period in the 70s and in the 60s and 70s, you had a decentralization of the news and information system again as cable companies sprouted up all over the country, mom and pop companies, bigger companies, African-American owned, Latino owned. You had sort of a whole new wave of decentralization of news and information flow. But gradually, because the safeguards put into place weren't strong enough, eventually two companies bought up everyone else. And so today in America, two companies, Comcast and Time Warner, dominate the cable systems of America and have sort of reestablished these sort of a centralized control over news and information. And but of course, that technology keeps developing. So the internet has destabilized everything all over again, and now the television networks are losing audience. The landline companies are losing subscribers to cell phones, and you have everything merging into the internet. And so now we are in the midst of what we believe is the fifth great debate in American history over media policy. The first was the postal system, the second was the telegraph, the third was radio, the fourth was cable, and now the fifth is the internet. What will be the new rules of operation that the government decides on for how news and information reaches the American people? We've tried to sort of come up with a theory of how all of this developed, but the fascinating issue of how race intersects with this is that we believe that whenever there has been local, diversified, decentralized news and information, people of color have been able to be heard and have been able to speak in a more forceful way than when things are centralized, so that it is in the direct interest of minority communities of African Americans and Latinos and Native Americans and Asians to advocate for the most decentralized ownership and the most decentralized system of news delivery possible. Because every time we go through a period of centralization, the voices of African American and Latino journalists and communities are drowned out and stifled.
We're talking to Juan Gonzalez. Reading your book, one gets a sense, a kind of wide angle on the terrible violence and just deep sickness of racism that goes back to our roots as a nation. It looks so similar today. It's like centuries of hysteria, basically. Where are we now? I mean, I sort of wonder what has significantly changed and what you're looking at when you look forward. I mean, that we still have commercial interests who are in favor of military and racist policies, and then these decentralized voices who then get drowned out when centralization comes into play. And now we have the internet, which is fundamentally decentralized, but then these net neutrality fights about centralization of the internet. What do you see? How do you see our most positive view forward?
Well, I think that there is no doubt that there is greater and more diverse content being produced in America today than ever before. The problem is, in the Associated Press decision in 1945, that basically struck down the monopoly of the Associated Press. I think it was Justice Frankfurter said that the First Amendment does not only deal with the right to speak, but the right to be heard. And everyone is speaking, but the question of how you can be, whether you can be heard, is really not so much a question of whether you can produce content, but really who controls the dissemination of the content. And I've come to the conclusion, and we don't get into the book too much in this because obviously we're dealing with a long historical approach, but I've come to the conclusion that the real issue right now in terms of the internet is not over content. It is over control of the means of transmission. The issue is who controls the pipes through which people will get their content. Comcast bought NBC, right? Comcast controls the pipes. They bought the content. Recently, Cablevision, a major regional cable company here in New York City, bought Newsday, the local newspaper, one of the big daily newspapers. Pretty soon, you're going to be getting an AT&T or an Apple, you know, buying another major media company. You already have some of the major internet companies turning into news companies. Yahoo, the most valuable part of Yahoo is Yahoo News. So what is happening is those who control the pipes are the new powerhouses of the media. The powerhouses of the American media today are obviously Google, Yahoo, Comcast, Time Warner. They're no longer the New York Times or the Washington Post or the ABC is still powerful. But at some point, the content providers now are secondary to those who control the pipes. And so therefore, the issue of not just what content you can produce, but who will be able to access your content, at what speed, at what cost. These are the issues that are central right now to news and information and to the public's right to know what's going on. So that's why it's so important, and we wrote this book to hopefully spur. There's already a very big grassroots media reform movement in the country. But unfortunately, one of the things that's happened in the last few years is we document in the book the critical role played by African-American, Latino, and Native American groups in media reform from the 1930s through the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. But something happened starting around the 1990s that is really disturbing, which is that many of the major civil rights organizations of our time began to take large amounts of money from major telecommunications companies and major cable companies, whether it's the NAACP or the National Council of La Raza or the Urban League or others. They're suddenly getting huge multi-million-dollar donations from the Time Warners and the AT&Ts and the Verizons of the world. And suddenly, these civil rights organizations are backing these companies in their lobbying battles in Washington. So from a time when the civil rights movement was standing for media reform, unfortunately, too many of our national civil rights leaders right now have lost their way and are now backing the telecom and the cable companies in their efforts to control the pipes. So one of our hopes is to remind people of this extraordinary legacy of how people of color have joined with progressive labor and citizen groups in the past to create a more democratic media system, and that we can't forget that, and we cannot now, because an organization is hurting and wants more scholarship money or needs to be able to continue its important social programs. You cannot sell your soul to some of these companies and then back them in lobbying efforts that in the long run will hurt the ability of all sectors of the American people to have a democratic and accountable media system.
Juan Gonzalez is the co-host of Democracy Now!, which airs twice a day here on KSFR. He's a columnist for the New York Daily News, and he's co-author with Joseph Torres of the new book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. Thanks so much for being with us on KSFR.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we look forward to seeing you at the Armory for the Arts.
Yes, I'll be there. Yes.
Great. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.